2-2 pitch. A swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Baseball America podcast. I'm Kyle Glazer. We're continuing our Top 10 Prospects podcast series today with the Cleveland Guardians. And to do that, we are joined by Teddy Cahill from beautiful Washington, D.C. Teddy, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Always good time to talk. Well, I shouldn't say always good time. This is the first time we're talking Guardians prospects here on the Baseball America podcast. So previously, it's been a good time talking Indians prospects. Now we're talking Guardians prospects.
Yeah, in that vein, this is an organization that is in transition. Obviously, first and foremost, the name change. The Cleveland Indians are now the Cleveland Guardians, and that's the biggest thing off the field. But on the field, this is an organization where there's just a lot of things in transition right now. Cleveland had its first losing season last year since 2012. They went 80-82. Before the season, obviously, they traded Francisco Lindor. He became the latest in a long line of stars to be traded away by the organization. After the season, Carter Hawkins, one of the rising stars in their front office, left to become the new general manager of the Chicago Cubs. It just feels like the Indians, or the Guardians, or Cleveland, as we said we're going to call them, for really the bulk of last decade, were a pretty stable organization. They made 5 playoff appearances in a 7-year span, or an 8-year span, I should say. They were consistently a team that was at the very least in the mid-80 wins range, and a lot of times they were, you know, 90, 91, 92, 93. But again, they've traded away a lot of key guys. And the other thing that really jumped out to me that was different about last year was, in the past, we've seen them trade away so many standout pitchers, Trevor Bauer, Mike Clevenger, Corey Kluber, and they've had guys come up and replace them somewhat seamlessly, Shane Bieber, Zach Plesac, Aaron Civale. Last year, the pitchers they called upon and were counting on to really kind of be the next wave of that, it didn't really work out. Kyle Quantrill had a really nice year, but Tristan McKenzie really struggled, was demoted at one point. Eli Morgan really struggled in 18 starts. Sam Henkes, Logan Allen, J.C. Mejia. I mean, all these things I feel like we've taken for granted would happen for Cleveland didn't really happen last year. And as a result, they had that losing record. Where is this organization right now, and what can we realistically expect moving forward here these next couple of years?
Well, I mean, I would push back on a lot of that. I mean, first of all, the pitching situation this year was a mess because they had the best pitcher in baseball injured and then several injuries beyond that. They would never want to break in as many rookies as they did last year. And the fact that Cal Quantrill went out and established himself as a future member of the rotation after the Padres had given up on him as a starter. And a lot of people had wondered whether he was just going to be better in the bullpen to begin with, I would qualify as a big success. And then you look at McKenzie and yeah, you can say that that was a disappointment. And, you know, you also have to remember that he was a rookie and, you know, he was on the prospect list a year ago and, you know, development is not linear and he pitched better at the end of the year. And I would still say that that's a future member of, you know, you're going to look to him to do something. I mean, would you have loved to have Eli Morgan, you know, do an Aaron Civale thing? Like, yeah, of course. But I mean, Eli Morgan is who he is. And, you know, frankly, the fact that he's was counted on to be a big league starter as long as he was last year says a lot more about just where the pitching staff is. I mean, yeah, they only won 80 games. Yeah, it was a losing season. And yeah, that's disappointing. But I mean, you know, it's not like they tanked. They were in contention for a while. And in a year where you trade one of the best players on the team, you know, I feel again, like you can't just ask them to keep going on the way that they are. They don't have the payroll that would allow for that to happen. You know, the Rays have down years as well. Everyone that operates a payroll in the neighborhood of where the Guardians have been operating a payroll is eventually going to have these years, going to have these cycles where they go down. And the key is just making sure that they happen infrequently and for very short periods of time. And so I guess that's now the big question is, where are they going from here? And it's going to be about the pitching, it just as it has been for a long time. A healthy Shane Bieber would go a long way to correcting a lot of what you saw in 2021.
Yeah, you kind of hit on the point there, which before we dive into the farm system, I do want to expand on that a little bit. Given what they have in the major leagues right now and given what they have in the farm system, how long do you expect this quote-unquote down cycle to last? Is this a one-year blip and they can contend again right away in 2022? Will it be maybe another year or two of 500-ish play? What realistically should we expect out of the Guardians moving forward?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by contend. You know, the division has gotten tougher around them, which is one of the issues that they're facing here, is that the White Sox went out and committed a whole bunch of money and made a bunch of win now moves, like hiring Tony La Russa. So they are out there trying to go out and win a World Series title right now. The Tigers are cycling up. You saw a lot of their prospects hit the big leagues. They got more on the way. They're just in an upswing right now. So, you're competing with them. You got to wonder where the Twins go after bottoming out last year. That I don't think anyone's expecting them to be quite so bad again. So then what does that look like? And so basically what I'm saying is the Central Division has gotten tougher. I think the Guardians have what it takes to compete for the playoffs. Whatever I guess that means in the new CBA, but is it realistic for them to close the gap on the White Sox all in one year? I mean, things would have to break right for them. I guess they would need to stay healthy, and they might need some help from other from the White Sox and not catching some of the breaks that they caught last year.
You mentioned this is an organization whose success has really been defined by its pitching for the better part of 5 or 6 years now. At the same time, looking at where this team's weaknesses are and what they have in the farm system, it does kind of dovetail nicely. And what I mean by that is you look at the Guardians, and this has been a fairly consistent story the last couple of years. Offensively, they have really struggled. They were in the bottom 10 in the major leagues in batting average, on base percentage, and OPS last year. They were more middle of the pack in slugging. But outside of Franmil Reyes and Jose Ramirez, there was just not a lot of consistent offensive production. But you look at this farm system as it currently stands, and as you ranked the top 10 prospects this year, 6 of their top 7 prospects are position players. Take us through this group and how much they could potentially be the answer to solving some of Cleveland's offensive shortcomings.
Well, I mean, you've got a fair number of position players here. There are a lot of them, though, are up the middle infielders, and I don't know how much you can really expect those guys to come in here and fix some of what has ailed the offense over the last few years. Tyler Freeman especially is, has great, hit ability. George Valera, when he comes up, he's always been compared to Juan Soto, and that's wildly unfair given what Juan Soto has become. But, the point is he can be an all-around hitter. A lot of what these guys stand out for, and I don't want to diminish anyone's offensive ability. Brian Rocchio is probably going to be a pretty good offensive player. But what gets him and what gets Arias and some of these other guys ranked so highly is that they're really high-end defensive shortstops. And, so I just would really caution putting too much on them when it comes time to, remake an offense that could use some power from other positions. And, the guys that are, looked at as being more of the power threats, like a Nolan Jones, he's coming off of one of, a disappointing year. Like if he had had a better year, he probably would have been in Cleveland last year instead of staying in AAA the whole time. So it's an interesting group. I think it has a lot of upside, but to look at it as, well, they're going to bring this wave in and be a great offensive team. Like, I just don't think that's not what they're there for. And that's not what they're going to be looked at to do.
As we dive into this farm system, Tyler Freeman took the number one spot. He's been one of the most consistent hitters, not just in the organization, but the entire minor leagues since he was drafted. He hit .323 last year. His career average is .319. Again, he's always hit for average, always gotten on base pretty much every level. His season was cut short last year by a small labrum tear in his shoulder that required season-ending surgery after he tried to come back from it. What is the outlook for Tyler Freeman right now, and where does he kind of fit into the Guardians' future plans?
Well, I mean, he's like I said, he stands out so much for his hit ability. He has just hit everywhere he's gone. Right now, he was at AA last year. They are generally an organization that believes in, you know, everyone making their moves, you know, going through the progression. And so I would expect that he'll go to AAA and they'll look for him to perform there. You could see him in Cleveland this year, I think, but he has to, you know, after having that surgery, the priority number one is just, you know, getting back up to game speed, and then you know, seeing where it goes from there. You would figure it could be, you know, he's been a shortstop his whole life, basically. A lot of people look at him more as a second baseman at the big league level. And I think that's definitely going to be true in Cleveland, just considering who is around him. But he has never betting against Tyler Freeman defensively has yet to prove to be correct. So, you know, we'll see, but I do think eventually second base is probably what you're looking at here.
Yeah. One of the things that just talking to scouts around the game before he went down with his injury was there's really a pretty strong confidence that second base is where he'll end up, but he should hit enough for the position. Consistent plus hit grades on him, just contact ability is elite, swing decisions, strike zone awareness. It's all there. Just a really good instinctual player in the box. There might not be the most impact there. Again, depending who you talk to, you'll get maybe it's 10 home runs, maybe it's 15, but if you're hitting 280, 290, 300 with 10 bombs, playing really good defense up the middle, that's a really good player. Given that that is the projection, how much discussion was there for him at number one compared to maybe some other players in the organization? Was it clear cut or was it a debate?
I mean, I'll push back on the idea that he's only going to hit 10 home runs. You know, like, who in the big leagues is only hitting 10 home runs with these rocket balls? You know, we heard this forever with Lindor. And I fell into the trap so many times about saying, well, like, how is Lindor ever going to hit for power? And like, where's the impact going to come from? And like, yeah, he's a gold glove shortstop, but like, what else is he going to do? Well, I mean, Francisco Lindor is an MVP candidate. So I'm not going to fall into that trap again. And that's not to say that Tyler Freeman is Francisco Lindor, but you know, with the balls that they play with in the big leagues, at least right now, I am not going to sit here and say anyone has 10 home run power. You know,
if Freddie Galvez can hit 20 home runs in the major leagues, you're right. Anything is possible.
Exactly. You know, so first of all that, and then second of all, I would say that I don't think the Guardians have a number one prospect. I think they have like five guys that you could rank number one, and you could rank and the converse of that means number one could be number five. I just don't think there's a whole lot of separation between these guys at the top. So yeah, plenty of discussion to be had about whether Freeman deserves to be number one or number three or number four, but you know, ultimately the hit ability and doing so at a high level is what landed Freeman number one.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, he's always hit, yeah, dating back to his days at Etowah High School, and someone that there is a track record here of exceeding expectations. I remember writing him up out of high school and people liked him, thought he was a good player, but there were a lot of people who thought that he was drafted maybe a touch high, that he wasn't quite in that day one consideration where the Indians at the time took him. And so far he's proven it at every level. So there is something to be said for expectations about his defense or his power. When the guy has a long track record of exceeding expectations, I think you do have to give it to him a little bit. With that, Teddy, we did have a lot of other players in this organization take a step forward last year. And as you mentioned, there were a lot of discussions about who should be number one. I want to dial in on Brian Rocchio a little bit. This is someone that people have been talking about for years as a really, really promising international signee. In 2020, wasn't able to get out of Venezuela due to the coronavirus pandemic restrictions and was kind of stuck at home playing on his own. Came back last year and really had one of the more impressive seasons of any player in the organization. Got up to AA, continued to play exceptional defense, showed more power than expected, 15 homers while stealing 21 bases, a lot of doubles. What do the Guardians have here, and how good can Brian Rocchio be?
I mean, I think he could be pretty good. I mean, you're looking at a player that has pretty consistently stood out for having above average shortstop defense, is a really heady player, just has an exceptional love and an understanding of the game. They nicknamed him the professor pretty early on in his tenure in the organization. And, you know, he's a guy that, like, yeah, he went back home when the pandemic started and then got stuck, like you said, but it's not like he sat around. He was continuing to play. He played a lot, from my understanding, down there in Venezuela. And, you know, he might've been the best player in the country at the time, just the way things had worked out. But, you know, he was out there and he was working hard, and you saw the results of that this year when he, you know, went out and did had the year that he did. I mean, he might be the shortstop of the future. There are obviously other players in the mix for that, but you know, if you made me pick one, I mean, he might be the guy just because of the combination of what he's done in all facets of the game and the rate at which he has progressed.
Yeah, just looking at the reports, the defense really just jumps out, just how natural and effortless it was. He anticipates, he's creative out there. It's really just kind of beautiful to watch him play shortstop in a lot of ways. One of the things I thought was interesting was the offensive numbers were very, very good. You look at what he did as a 20-year-old, getting up to double A, hitting for average, getting on base, hitting for power. But some of the scouting reports didn't quite match up with the numbers. It seemed like there was kind of a split. There were a couple of evaluators who said that while they understood the numbers were good right now against the competition he was facing, they had some questions about how offensively impactful he would be in the major leagues. What is kind of the outlook for his offense right now, and what kind of hitter he projects to be? Because it does seem to be a little bit divisive.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question is that, okay, he hit 15 home runs, but what did that 15 actually mean? And, you know, like I just said with Freeman, I'm not going to sit here and doubt anyone's ability to hit home runs with the big league setup today. But, you know, that's never been his game before. And it just doesn't seem like he's going to suddenly become a, you know, 20 home run a year hitter or whatever. He's a guy that, like so many Indians prospects or Guardians prospects, because this is what the organization, you know, really values and looks for as much as they can. He has just a great innate ability with the bat. You know, he has great barrel control, controls the strike zone well, and really that's his game. And if power comes with that, then, well, I mean, maybe power is going to come with that. But right now, I think you're looking at a player that is more going to be attuned to, you know, hitting line drives, spraying those around the park rather than, you know, hitting a bunch of home runs.
Yeah, and even if it takes him some time to adjust, one of the things that's come up is his defense will keep him there. And we do see that sometimes. Really, really gifted defensive shortstops, they come up, their defense keeps them around in the majors. And then as they just get a little bit bigger, a little bit older, a little more mature, all of a sudden we see the bat really start to come around at 26, 27. So certainly a promising prospect. And no matter how the offense develops, there's a sense he can be an impact player. Again, even if it takes some time, that the bat could still potentially make him a true, you know, everyday standout type of player with his defense. Teddy, putting together this top five, you mentioned that any of these five really could have been number one. With that, is there a clear-cut delineation after this top five? Did anyone in the 6-7 range? Because these are guys we've seen in the top half of the organization before, or was it this clear-cut top five?
I mean, I kind of think at this point, it is a clear five. If you really still believe in Nolan Jones, I think you can make a case. I mean, the pedigree is still there. A lot of the raw tools are still there. But this is a player that hit 238 in AAA. He hit 13 home runs is all. And this is a guy that has long had questions about, can he remain at third base? And, you know, even if those questions weren't there, even if you're a believer in Nolan Jones's defense, which I kind of generally am, you know, we're still talking about a third baseman and not a middle infielder. So, you know, I do think there's kind of the split there. I mean, you see Jones, you see Bo Naylor, back there. But those are guys coming off of disappointing offensive seasons, and there's still reason to believe in them going forward. But I think that when you compare them to the players that are in the top five, it just looks a little bit different.
All right. Well, I want to dive into Jones and Naylor a little more, as well as the rest of this system. First, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out. And when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
And we are back with Teddy Cahill breaking down the Cleveland Guardians farm system. All right, Teddy, before we went to break, you mentioned Nolan Jones and Bo Naylor having struggled last season, and as a result, still being in this top 10, but falling out of the top five when both of them had been kind of staples of it in recent years. What is the outlook for these two right now? Both of them really, really struggled offensively. You mentioned Jones at AAA, Naylor at AA. What realistically can Guardians fans expect from these two moving forward?
Well, I think the big thing to remember with both of them is that Nolan Jones is going to be 23 on opening day, and Bo Naylor is going to be 22. We're talking about guys that have gotten to the upper levels at pretty young ages. So they do have that going for them. And I think that's especially true for Naylor, who obviously is a year younger and B, a catcher. So Bo Naylor is going to have to hit better than 188, 280, 332 going forward. That's clear. He needs more consistency at the plate. But this is a guy that is a pretty athletic guy behind the plate and brings value defensively. So, I feel like Bo Naylor is ranked behind Nolan Jones, but I feel like a little less concerned about that. Just there's less pressure on his bat. And so for him to be a valuable player for the Guardians going forward, obviously there's just more of an avenue to that. Jones has a better track record for hitting. So I think that's what you kind of have to just rely on, that he's going to be able to make the adjustments and get back to that. And maybe he was pushing himself too much last year because he realized what could happen with a good season in Columbus, that, you know, Cleveland is, you know, he's really getting close to the big leagues now. But you also do have to realize that that's the, when you get to AAA, it's really the first time you're seeing matchup specialists come in to face you. It's the, you know, it's a time when you're, as a younger player, you're facing guys who might be 10 years older than you with serious big league time that are trying to get back to the big leagues, that really want to get you out, that aren't sitting there working on their stuff. So it's a time for every young hitter to, you know, they have to make adjustments. And now we're going to have to see what Nolan Jones was able to cook up here in the offseason.
Yeah, one of the things that came up with Jones, and looking at some of the data, this was kind of borne out, that he really, really struggled with spin. What are some of the things he's working on in that regard, and what are some of the things the organization wants to see from him moving forward in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the biggest thing for him right now is to get better at that. And as a left-handed hitter, you know, again, you don't see as many lefty specialists early in your minor league career. So having gone to that experience in AAA, just getting better at identifying spin, getting better at laying off the chase pitches, those are two of the big things. And I mean, they go back to, you know, broader things that Jones is good at and can be good at and can get back to being good at, but needs to remember that, you know, controlling the strike zone is part of what made him an attractive player to this organization to begin with. And so you can't be as eager to chase pitches, especially, you know, spin.
Yeah, one thing that's encouraging is he finished the year strong in August. He didn't play in September, but he finished August off very, very strong. So something that could potentially be, you know, something he can build on. With Naylor, in his pro debut at low A, offensively the numbers weren't great, but you looked at it from the perspective of he's a catcher, first full season, what the league is, being the Midwest League, a lot of young kids struggle there early. So you kind of gave him some benefit of the doubt. I know I was surprised. The Guardians pushed a lot of prospects very aggressively last year, given there was no 2020 minor league season. That really did stand out to me when I saw their opening day assignments. And a lot of kids did make the jump. Gabriel Arias going from high A to triple A held his own. We talked about Rocchio already. But Naylor was someone who struggled with this large jump, and the reviews on his bat were just not great. They kind of lined up with a lot of what we saw in terms of the performance, but it did come up a few times that a couple of evaluators felt he just wasn't ready for the level. He just wasn't ready to be seeing the quality of pitching he was seeing in some cases. How do you kind of assess his year, and what is next for him?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a challenging thing for Naylor, because he's always been young for the level. There's always been an explanation for why he might not have performed as well as you would expect. But at the same time, he struck out in 31.5% of his plate appearances in 2022 or 2021. And he had, you know, the last time we saw him in 2019, he had struck out in just 23% of them. So that is one thing that absolutely has to get corrected. He had been one of the best offensive performers at the alternate team site in 2020. And I think that's part of the reason why the aggressive assignment was made, but it obviously had its challenges. And now you're going to see him get another look at the upper minors, and he'll be 22, and ideally the experience will be better for it. But we'll just have to see. Obviously, offensively, he's got to find more consistency. And that's true. That was true in 2019. He got off to a slow start there. And again, it's cold in the Midwest League. He was like the youngest everyday player or thereabouts in the Midwest League that year. All of it's understandable, but at some point you do have to see, you have to see the tools turn into production.
Is it more of an approach issue or a swing issue?
You know, I think it was more about approach this year than about swing. But I think that, you know, there are some things that he could fine tune in the swing, but I think generally it's more, you're looking at how do you get used to facing better pitching than you'd seen previously? And then how do you lock in at bat to at bat?
With that, these top seven, again, are all guys who are fairly prominent. And I think from an outsider's perspective, you would expect it to have seen them in the top 10 in this organization ranking. How many other guys were kind of clear locks for the top 10 versus maybe guys that were kind of on the fence? How many guys were kind of in the mix for these 8 through 10 spots, if you will?
I think the next couple spots were pretty well locked in. I mean, you draft a first round pick, you know, usually that's that player is going to move into the top 10. I think that's true in almost any organization there. Every once in a while you see a team that had a really deep and strong top 10 and maybe picked at the back of the first round. And, you know, that team's first round pick doesn't get in. I actually think that happened to the Guardians just a year ago, but that's the rare exception. Commonly the first round pick enters the top 10. So Gavin Williams being the first round pick this year, massive fastball. That was a pretty easy going in. And then, I mean, you could make arguments for other players, for the 9 and the 10 spot, but the way Logan Allen pitched this year, the way that he moved so quickly through the minor leagues, and the way that he's established himself as one of the next guys up in the pitching pipeline, I think he pretty well earned that spot as well.
Yeah, he had one of the best seasons in the minor leagues. What does he do well and what does he project to be?
Well, he has always stood out for his pitchability going back to his high school days. He's not the biggest guy. They list him at 6'1", 180. And so he doesn't have massive stuff, though his velo has ticked up in recent years. And, he can touch 95, but he's not sitting there. This is a guy that is really relying more on pitchability and control and his changeup, which is, a plus offering. But he just really understands what he needs to do to get outs. He controls, his fastball into all four quadrants of the strike zone. And the way that he, approaches hitters, he was really able to make quick work of the low minors, played well, at all levels, but I am going to be interested when he faces more advanced competition, how he adjusts to that.
Teddy, as we put together our organization talent rankings, the Guardians checked in at number 12, not quite top 10, but top half of baseball pretty firmly and a pretty solid ranking. And one of the things that jumps out to me about this system, you mentioned there's not really a clear cut number one. You got five guys who are pretty good. This back 10 group is players who have shown potential in the past but have struggled, or players who are good but have some questions. What really stands out to me about this organization more than the top 10 per se is the depth. There's a lot of guys, as you look at this 11 to 30 group, who are getting good reviews and you can see really taking off. You look at Jose Tina, Peyton Battenfield, Cody Morris, John Kenzie Noel, Tobias Meyer, Stephen Kwan, Xavion Curry. It does seem there's guys sprinkled in here in the 11 to 30 range that all have a chance to be pretty good. How much of this organization's strength is their prospect depth, maybe more than just the top 10?
I mean, it is like that. That is where the strength is. The strength is that it's a strong organization 1 to 10, and it's strong 1 through 30. It's strong 1 through 50, however deep you want to go. There aren't many systems that have this kind of depth. And I mean, this is really a philosophical argument to be had when you, suss out org rankings. How much emphasis do you place on, who is the best prospect in this system and who's the second best prospect? Like how much do the stars at the top matter versus the depth? And if you're into depth, this is, I mean, I can't imagine that there are more than a couple organizations in baseball that have better depth than what Cleveland does. Now, if you're looking for that star power, if you're looking for those guys who had breakout years, who rank in the top 25, 30 prospects in all of baseball, I mean, this is not necessarily where you're looking. I guess that leads to how they rank outside the top 10 again organizationally, but the depth, just the number of bites at the apple that the Guardians have in terms of pitching prospects, in terms of middle infield prospects, that's absolutely where the depth is. And what would be exciting is that you're not riding on Tyler Freeman to make it. If Tyler Freeman doesn't make it, that's really unfortunate for them as an organization, but there are other middle infielders behind him And you would hope that they would hit on one or two of those.
So given that, who are some of the top guys in the 11 to 30 range that really jump out for you? I love Cody Morris. What I saw from him was impressive. He's probably the guy I'm looking at, but who are some of the guys you're looking at that could really, really pop here?
Well, Jose Tana at 11 is a cheat because he's 11. Honestly, if I redid the list right now, he might be 10. He might be 9. He's really good. He's definitely one for me. Jonkenzie Noel is a big right-handed hitting corner infield type, and he's got some serious power. And I've been excited about him for a couple of years, and you started to see that breakout last year. And there's more in the tank to be found. And then I like what they got in Tobias Myers. He came over in the offseason in a trade from the Rays, and I think they got an intriguing prospect on the mound in him. I mean, adding again to further depth on the mound, I think that was an intriguing pickup for them before the lockout went into effect.
Yeah, there's no question. I will say, as I kind of think about it, who are the deepest systems in baseball? The Pirates, the Rays, and the Guardians. I mean, those are the three that jump out to me off the top of my head. I do want to ask about Stephen Kwan. This was someone who was at Oregon State, was known as an undersized bat-to-ball type of outfielder. You don't really know how much impact there's going to be. And he made some changes last year and really started getting into some power. He really jumped analytically, and that got us and a lot of other people starting to ask around about him from a scout perspective. And the reports kept coming back pretty good that with the changes he's made, he's a big leaguer. It's just a matter of what degree. What is the latest on Stephen Kwan, and what do the Guardians have here?
That is a massive question. He's divisive. You're talking about a player that's listed at 5'9". 175. You want to talk about questions about how much he's going to impact the baseball? Like, this is the operative question about him. He was kind of a slap hitting leadoff hitter prior to this year, and then this year he went out and he showed a lot more power. He hit a bunch of home runs, but he did it in Akron and Columbus, which are hitter friendly ballparks. So what is real here is a huge question. Is he suddenly going to become a player that has above average speed and is going to hit for some power? Because that's a really exciting player. Or is his size and his approach at the plate, are those more suited to being kind of the slap hitting leadoff type, which generally has been out of vogue in baseball in recent years? And I don't have an answer to that question. I know I fall generally more on, well, I would love to see him do that again before I buy in totally. But I also know that, like we talked about with Freeman, this is a guy that betting against him has been a fool's errand. And, betting against Stephen Kwan now, coming off of his best year as a pro seems especially foolish. But he is going to, to me, I need to see that again, that kind of power again. And the Guardians have had players like this before, and it hasn't quite worked out. So I'm working on some of this like prior track record stuff that is maybe not getting out of my head fast enough. Maybe I'm not catching up to where Kwan is today, but he is a fascinating player that is one of the players to watch in 2022. Just because I feel like if what you saw last year was real, that's a guy that can be an impact player. For can get into the Guardians lineup quickly, here this season, or maybe you're going to see a different Kwan, the one more like we were accustomed to before the 2021 season.
Yeah, we'll see. Again, it's a good thing when you have an intriguing player in your 20 to 30 range of your system, because sometimes you're struggling to find guys who have a whole lot of anything. And you look at the 20 to 30 group in this organization, and it's guys who have performed, it's guys who have some intriguing tools, it's guys who, even if you have some questions, there's something there that gets you a little bit excited. So we'll see what him and the rest of the prospects here in the system are able to do. Teddy, before we wrap up, any final thoughts on the Guardians organization? Really top to bottom, majors, minors, just how this is all going to fit together?
Well, I mean, we're talking about intriguing things here with Kwan, and he's kind of also a poster child of another issue that they have going into this year is that the lockout has the potential to really affect Cleveland's prospects more than any other system, because they went through and they kind of redid their 40-man roster at the roster deadline in November. And now a huge percentage of this list is on their 40-man roster. And that means that they can't be in spring training. Like, when minor league camp opens, those guys can't be there, assuming the lockout is still going on. And so what is that going to mean? How long is this lockout going to last? How far behind does that put some of these players? I mean, these are unknowables, obviously, right now, but they are something to watch, and a quicker resolution to the situation. Obviously, it's good for everyone in baseball, but particularly for Cleveland, as a lot of these players should be in Arizona right now working out with the big league team, and they're missing out on a chance for those reps, and they'll miss out on a chance for their reps once minor league camps do open as well.
Yeah, by my count, 13 prospects on this top 30 list are now on the 40-man roster, most of whom have never played a day in the major leagues, and some of whom have never played a day even in AAA. So these guys need the reps, and even if the lockout extends into the season, if potentially they're not able to play the first couple of weeks of the season, that could set them back. So certainly not something anyone wants, and hopefully for baseball as a whole, that gets figured out sooner rather than later. But that's a very good point that the Guardians are an organization that could be impacted more adversely than any other team, and hopefully that doesn't happen. Teddy, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your insight as always.
Absolutely. Always good time, like I said.
All right, everyone, that'll do it for another Baseball America Prospects podcast. Go ahead and give us a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever platform you're listening on. We'd love to hear from you. For Teddy Cahill, I'm Kyle Glazer. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, everybody.